Thank you for downloading this podcast of Julie Moore discussing golf and the common, recorded at the British Society of Sports History Northwest Workshop in November 2012.
Well, as somebody who spent most of her life avoiding any form of sport and comes from Hertfordshire, I feel a bit of an interloper, but the research for this is very much work in progress. It came out of a small section that I looked at in my thesis, which was looking at agricultural depression, land ownership change in the latter part of the 19th century in Hertfordshire. And I made a note at that time to go back and have another look. So this is very much early days. And I appreciate any comments and suggestions from people who know far more about sports history than I do. Hertfordshire's one of the smaller counties of Britain. And at the end of the 19th century, it experienced two distinct patterns of population growth, which tell the story of the county at the time. For those of you unaware of where we sit, we're one of the home counties, just north of London. In fact, that southern border is about 15 miles from the centre of the capital. This is a railway map from 1903. It's fairly crowded. It's not a particularly good map, but I think it does give you an idea of the sort of crowded network of trains that were available in this part of the county. In 1895... the author of a guidebook to Hertfordshire for cyclists warned its readers to avoid the town of Watford, which is down here, because, and I quote, "it is now practically a London suburb in which silk hats are common objects." In contrast, the same guidebook, looking at this area around Royston, promoted the villages around here as being very primitive and worth seeing. And it's clear that these districts of Watford and Royston were experiencing two very different trajectories at this time. With its poorer soils, its greater dependency on agricultural income, lack of railway accommodation, this northeastern district was struggling to keep its population anchored in the area. In the 50 years after 1851, Royston Registration District experienced a fall in population of 26%. Whilst neighbouring districts of Bishop Stortford, around here, and Hitchin saw modest growths of only 9 and 16% respectively. In contrast, the district of Watford experienced a rapid growth of 187% in the same period, closely followed by Barnet with 184% and St Albans at 83%. And this was a change fuelled very much by the arrival of professional families and the staff who would service their households. These are the people who are moving out from London at this time, attracted by that promise of a rural atmosphere but with easy access to their respective employment in London. That commentary of the cyclist guide is also revealing of a gap in understanding between the excursionists and those who earn their living from the rural economy. If we then look at the growth of golf clubs, it's not really too surprising to see they mirror that growth in population, so most of them are centred around this area. Hertfordshire had always attracted those, since Tudor times, those who needed to be at the courts, the counting houses, the court of the king, the counting houses. Since Tudor times, but these men, for the very most part, were very wealthy and looking to buy a country house, put down roots, and use their landed estate as a power base. The changing political and economic situation at the end of the 19th century, with the introduction of the secret ballot, the widening of the franchise, falling agricultural prices, and the subsequent fall in land prices, meant that the large country estate was no longer the attraction that it had been when land was the source of economic wealth and political power. The newly wealthy, who had made their fortunes servicing the domestic needs of a growing middle class, men such as Maple of Tottenham Court Road, the grocers Edmund Cross and Samuel Blackwell, Barker of Kensington, and the vintner Walter Gilby, men such as these continued that earlier custom of buying a country house, but more with a view to locating their families in a pleasant environment, which offered them ease of contact with their business interests in the capital. More importantly for the story of golf in the county was the new story for this time, the arrival of those large numbers of professional men and their families who settled in the parts of the county which had good access to the railway and also offered the promise of their own little piece of the rural idyll, which was so much a feature of the late 19th century urban imagination. It's interesting, actually, the notices for sale of estates up to around 1870 all stress the good rental income that these estates will bring to their owner. But after that, it's much more emphasis on the potential for development and the idea of building villas which offer hunting, shooting, fishing and latterly golf on the doorstep. So Richard Holt has written that golf gave the illusion of country life but required neither skills with arms nor horsemanship. And as such, it proved attractive to those who were moving into the county and hoping to partake of that part of the rural Lidl. For it carried none of the potential humiliation or the danger of the unwieldy gun or unforgiving hedge. The merchants, brokers and lawyers who had made the move into the county found in the playing of a round of golf an opportunity for fresh air, exercise and social interaction with like-minded fellows, which came close to the package of benefits they believed they were buying along with their first-class season ticket. And in the common, they saw the natural empty space, I use empty in that inverted commas, where such ambitions might be fulfilled. The common as a site for the spending of leisure time was not an idea which arrived with the first of the new wealthy or the commuter. It had always been a shared space available for more than just economic exploitation. Where they existed as open spaces, as at Harpenden, this is Harpenden up here, they were natural sites for fairs, football and cricket matches between villages, horse races and local celebrations. However, by their nature, such events were inclusive of the local population. And as the population expanded, the common continued to offer these traditional pleasures. But the arrival of the new wealthy and their middle class neighbours saw a shift in how that space was interpreted. This table, I've comprised this. This is the list of golf clubs which appear in Kelly's Trade Directory for 1912, and it's the formally constituted golf clubs, so it may underestimate the playing of the golf on the common or heathland within the county. However, whilst as at Berkhamsted and Chorley Wood, golfers have been hacking around the common for some years before the common was formed. The club was formally constituted, it's the arrival of the organised and exclusive club which marks a real shift in how the common was experienced. So as you can see, the earliest golf clubs were laid out on common land. The story of those which follows reflects the other strands of the Hertfordshire story, with older aristocratic families seeking to increase revenue at a time of falling rentals, alongside the newly wealthy who could afford to set aside land for their sport. The Earl of Essex leased 250 acres of parkland at £250 a year to members of the Bushy Hall Club, who formed a new club, the West Harts Club, in 1896. Whilst A.J. Sanderman, who was from the Port family, he paid £3,100 for 89 acres of Lime Kiln Farm, which adjoined his newly bought Presdale's estate, for the express purpose of building a golf course. Sanderman's not alone. Oh, sorry. Oh, no. Okay. Yes, Sanderman's not alone. There we've got these people here, Grace, Gordon, Gilby, Blackwell. Again, all members of that new wealthy breed who were moving into the county at the time. But focusing on the golf courses which lay on the common, Harpenden, the initiative for a club, followed a letter written to the local newspaper by one who signed himself A. Putter, and wrote to propose that a new golf club be formed on the common, as it only required the permission of the trustees to remove some of the firs for greens to be laid, which would then attract a sufficient number of gentlemen from Harpenden, St Albans and Luton to form a very respectable club. At Boxmoor, Boxmoor was the nearest station to Hemel Hempstead, and a group of men on their daily commute to London proposed approaching the Boxmoor Common Trust for permission to establish a links-type course on Sheethanger Common. Their first meetings were actually held in the first-class carriages on the evening train back to Boxmoor Station from Euston, and subsequently at the station itself. And the approach to the trustees was made by six men who were bankers, merchants and one stockbroker, supported by the local vicar. In 1891, the majority of the 300 members of Bushy Golf Club, down here, were barristers, stockbrokers and solicitors. And that occupational profile is repeated up at Gustard Wood. The members' handbook for Gusted Wood gives details of those first members, and cross-referencing with the census and the birthplace of their children as a guide, it's possible to say that many of these members had only arrived in the county during the latter part of the 1880s. Gustard Wood also had a number of members who gave their addresses as London and whose connection with Hertfordshire is not clear, perhaps friends of the family, business colleagues. As you can imagine, these new golf clubs attracted people from London. At Chorley Wood, members included Alpha Balfour, who seems to have joined nearly every golf club he could find going, the Bishop of London, and many who were titled, indicating they come from aristocratic families. Here we have Chorley Wood down here. Arthur Balfour must have been a real golf fanatic, as even as Prime Minister in 1902, he managed to maintain a handicap of 8, which I'm told by those who know is a sign of a serious commitment to the game. And the London connection continues. Berkhamsted, Gustard Wood and Chorley Wood all approached railway companies and negotiated special rates and additional stopping trains to bring members from London to the local station. At Royston, right up here in the northeast, the GNR offered members reduced fares from both London's King's Cross and Cambridge to those who could show proof of membership. And Royston's an interesting one because it's slightly different. In 1892, the newly formed golf club, there were reports in the local press that this was actually going to be the Cambridge University Golf Club, and the secretary of the golf club writes in to complain and say, no, this is a club conceived by and for the gentlemen of Royston. But in fact, members from Cambridge University, dons and students, did join, and the rumours seem to have got about because Cambridge University students had been travelling out informally to the local heath and using it for their own games. So that's how the rumours initiated. So whilst the earliest golf clubs were not enclosed with fences or railings, they were nevertheless, with their high joining and annual fees, plus monitoring of membership, an exclusive space denied to many of those who had previously used the common freely. At Chorley Wood, the membership was confined to 150, and the members were required to wear a rather splendid scarlet coat with collars, cuffs and facings in yellow and brass buttons bearing the Hertfordshire County crest. The rationale being that such an unmissable piece of clothing was to make the wearer visible to other golfers and to those who were using the common, warning them that balls might be flying through the air. However, as it was also required dress for all meetings and club dinners, it's hard to escape the thought this was just more a case of announcing one's arrival than an example of health and safety in action. And restriction on numbers was sometimes dictated by the practicalities of the course, but again, this reinforces that exclusivity. So at Boxmoor, which was only a 9-hole course, numbers were restricted to 40, and an entrance fee of 2 guineas plus an annual subscription of 4 guineas was required. At Gustard Wood, where again the membership came from that wealthier end of the community, the joining fee was 2 guineas plus an annual fee of 1 guinea. Lady members paid 0.5 guinea, although any member who gave notice of his absence abroad for a year could have the annual fee waived, which again gives an indication of the sort of person they think they're going to attract. At Berkhamsted, up here, the story was rather more inclusive, and in part, one wonders whether this was a result of those early problems with enclosure, which saw mass action by members of the Commons Preservation Society following the 1866 enclosure of part of the Common by the trustees of Earl Brownlow. George Wybrow, who was a member of the Commons Open Spaces and Footpaths Preservation Society, so vigilant on the protection of the Commons, wrote a history of Berkhamsted Common in 1934, in which he devoted a chapter to the place of the golf club and wrote of it approvingly as one whose approach to its place in the district was typified by a motto of good golf and bread and cheese, a contrast he drew to other clubs where an over-concern with the clubhouse facilities and fine dining excluded all but the well-to-do. Berkhamsted was also one of the first golf courses in the county to set up an artisans section, and this seems to have been a response to the fact that a continuing belief amongst the people of the town that they had rights over the space, and so they were turning up and playing on the golf course alongside those who paid their subscriptions. One of the issues noted when drawing up the lease between the golf club and Earl Brownlow was the absence of any register of commoners, which made the question of rights problematic. By setting up the artisans section, the club seems to have hoped they could formalise this sentiment into more practical arrangements. And certainly Wybrow characterised the club as having managed to live on good terms with the public. Trying to ascertain levels of opposition to the presence of golfers on the common is not always straightforward, as resistance could be of the type that which creates nuisance without reaching the headlines. I was recently told at a meeting of some Hertfordshire local historians of the story of a builder who from Royston who was so irritated by the golf club that he would stack all his wood on the green and then when asked to move it would do so by taking far too many carts and horses than was necessary to drag it off the green, so thereby creating more of a nuisance. And again, he claimed it was his right to do this. Chorley Wood... Wybrow's 1934 view of Berkhamsted Golf Club was fairly benign and a beneficial presence on the common. But as John Lowison has highlighted, the Commons Preservation Society watched the spread of golf courses on the common with some concern, as they were seen as a sort of almost a back way to enclosure and exclusion. At Chorley Wood, stewardship of the common was held by John Saunders Gilliatt, who, although he didn't play golf himself, was president of the local golf club. And there was quite a great deal of resentment at Chorley Wood, whether or not his position as president of the golf club also led this idea that the golf club could more or less dictate terms. There were complaints made of the pond becoming unfit for use because all the golfers were going into the pond looking for their lost balls. I don't know if they did it in these splendid coats of theirs, but so they sent the caddies in, I don't know. But so they were stirring up the ponds and making the water undrinkable for the local cattle. And in 1910, local people vented their anger at the idea that the golf club would be actually open on a Sunday by driving cattle onto greens. The subsequent meetings did little to appease fears of the golf club setting their own rules, and this is the only golf club I found where murmurings against it continue into the post-World War I period. There was even talk at one point of the club closing, and the local historian says it will be missed by nobody. So they obviously had their problems at Chorley Wood. Whether, again, that reflected the high number of outsiders who were joining, I don't know. At Gustard Wood, in March 1898, Frederick Wright, who was a nurseryman and copyholder of the common, brought two members of the club, together with two local policemen, before the St Albans Divisional Bench on a charge of assault, after they tried to move him on when he blocked a green. The newspaper report claimed that he was grazing his sheep, as he claimed was his right. However, witness statements gathered by the club's solicitor show he had no sheep with him. He stood on the green, blocking the hole. He actually had his feet like that, so that anybody trying to get the ball into the hole would be blocked. And he told one of his employees to go off and fetch a barrow load of clay and a watering can with which he intended to block up every hole on the course. When told to move on by the police, he threw himself rather theatrically to the ground and claimed he was injured. He then was left lying on the ground, at which point he sort of got up and went away, and the club thought that was the end of it. In fact, it looks like Wright was spoiling for a fight because he'd actually bought 3.5 acres, copyhold rights over 3.5 acres, only earlier that year in January. So it looks like he was looking for some sort of showdown. His protest was ostensibly against cutting of the turf to provide a putting surface, but when the case came before the magistrates, it was deemed by the magistrates as one of over rights which they had no jurisdiction, and it would have to go to a higher court. They refused to prosecute the assault on the grounds it was a threatening halfpenny assault and not worth talking about. Because Wright didn't have the money, the case didn't go any further. Although there's a sense from the reports that actually, from the statements by the club, that they would have quite welcomed the opportunity to get this aired in court and get some sort of ruling on the rights.
2 minutes.
2 minutes, right. Okay, thank you. So concerned were they after this that they actually approached the ecclesiastical commissioners who were the common for a formal tenancy agreement, and They managed to draw one up. They did also want to sign some agreement with the commoners, but it was agreed that only the commoners who had no objection would sign, so it wouldn't guarantee any lack of action in the past. Wright actually had previous with the golf club. He had been in conflict with them several times before. But it did seem on this occasion that rather than being a case of commoners' rights, his grievance was based on his annoyance that the orders for food and drink for a celebration of a Queen's Jubilee, which had been organised and financed by the club, had not been given to his own local shop, but to a local publican, who had, in spite of reassurances to the contrary, ordered supplies from beyond the village. The question of this local economy is an interesting one, as golf clubs seem very keen in their histories to stress their contribution to local economy. There were local entrepreneurs who took advantage of men and ladies who needed transport from stations to the golf courses, and those who supplied refreshments. So this, I couldn't resist the picture, then I had to think of something to include. But this is Boxmoor, and the reason I... Is that me? The reason I've included this as well is because of these two young caddies. And one of the arguments put forward was the contribution the golf club made to family budgets. In the Gusted Woodcart case, there was a rather golden assessment by one witness which said that the golf club has been a very great boon to the people residing on the common. They're better clad and fed and better to do in every way. The children earning from 40 to 45 shillings each. On the day of the alleged assault, the caddies earned £3 between them, which seems an enormous amount of money. Both the caddies on the day gave evidence supporting statements of those accused of using force on Wright. But the caddies at Boxmoor, interestingly, received fourpence a round, which does throw the question of the money paid to the Gusted Wood lads and how typical that was. So that's something else that needs to be looked at. Those who were unimpressed by the economic argument pointed to the fact that many of these clubs pay little or any rent. At one end, we have Harpenden. Sir John Bennett Laws agreed to a token rent of a shilling a year. Slightly more expensive was Gusted Wood, who, when they took out their lease, paid £10 a year. But you can imagine how this sat with people who believed that they were already... restricted by the golf club, and the golf club seemed to be getting away scot-free. So, as I said, this is work in progress. But it does seem to me that the impact of the golf course obviously shapes the golf course, the commons that we have today. But I do think this is part of a wider phenomenon of these people moving out, becoming very interested in their local environment and staking a claim on the commons as something which belongs to the community. It protects property values, and Hertfordshire today has a very high percentage survival rate for its commons and its village greens, which may in some small part have something to do with golf club. As a golf widow of 25 years standing, it really goes against the grain to give them any credit, but nevertheless. And okay, I'll stop there.
Thank you very much. Okay, questions?
No, good, okay.
No, I know that really wants some feedback on this because it is a work in progress. Mark?
Sorry, I'll just raise something that come to mind about cricket. Is there anything you can say about cricket that it was to a smaller extent that, you tell me that cricketers were on the village green rather than the commons?
I would say so, that, but I have nothing to base that on other than just sort of anecdotes I've come across. And so my assumption is that the needs of a cricket pitch require much more upkeep, don't they? A golf club, you can see what it's like. I'm told Boxmoor today. I think Boxmoor's actually just closed, but it is incredibly hilly, rough ground. I think my reading of it is a village cricket. Pitch would be, and also more inclusive. I'm just thinking out loud here, but would it not be more inclusive because very much they were for a village, and therefore they were they might have had some sort of local worthy who captained the team or ran the team, but they would be expecting it to include the village, and therefore the village green would make sense. So yes, but yeah, so that, but I that's just speculation. I don't know anything about it, I'm afraid. So. Yeah. Yes.
Can I just ask you whether you've come across the Commons Old Spaces Society and whether you've researched their involvement?
No, I haven't.
The Commons Old Spaces Society was obviously very active in the late 19th century in protecting commons from enclosure and so on and so forth. That they must have had some views on the use of commons for golf courses and the like.
Yeah, well, certainly Lowerson mentions them as being concerned. I came at them through Berkhamsted, because obviously Berkhamsted does have that earlier history with the Commons Preservation Society. So that's where that came out of. But in actually looking at their records more closely, no, I haven't. I mean, I don't even know, are they available? Are they?
Well, I don't know.
No, but certainly that would be...
But one would imagine that local people, if they were interested in preserving their code, they would enrol or try and attach to some support from the society.
I went to a talk recently by, well, last week, Alan Hawkins was talking, and he was talking about the Commons Preservation Society, and he was talking about it very much as they weren't interested in the poor, the way sort of the poorer people were using the common, who I suspect are the people who are... another thing that I've been alerted to and I haven't had a chance to look at is the idea of sort of plant maiming, so maiming of trees and this sort of thing, as people were planting on the... aesthetically, they try to improve the common, that sort of thing. And he was pointing to the fact that the Commons Preservation Society were not really interested. It was about rights, commoners' rights. So I don't know. I haven't. But it's really, as I say, there's so many places you can go with this. So,
yours is an interesting one, in that, you know, commons have always been a site of conflict.
Yes.
You know, and it's been a conflict over grazing. It's been conflict over a whole series of different uses, from horse racing on, you know, and political meetings and all the rest. And I guess one of the things you see here, though, is that attempted appropriation by a particular social group trying to establish use when actually they have no rights whatsoever, so they're simply appropriating and demand, you know, assuming rights.
Yes.
And it's so in the Foucauldian sense, it's all about power and how it can be used.
I don't think they saw a problem. I think they moved out there, they bought these lovely houses, they saw what they thought of as empty land, and they wanted to use it.
And it's about representation.
Yeah.
So it, in a sense, it's about imagery, it's about representations, it's about very, very different perceptions of the same area.
Yeah.
And I think that area of perception and how that's culturally constructed might be an area which you could open up more. In
I think you're right, yeah.
There's not a lot at the moment, you know, you haven't got a lot of material about how that ground is thought of by different groups and different amounts of power within there.
Yes.
Within particular areas.
Yeah. I mean, it's quite difficult to get at the sort of protest, because I suspect a lot of people, it is that sort of almost that dumb resistance that goes on, and people perhaps walking their dogs deliberately to annoy. But I think, I honestly think they just moved out there and they did not see a problem at all. They really thought, there's space for everybody. Why can't we all, you know, we could all have space on the common. And
the local authorities say anything about it?
Not that I've come across, no. I've moved on from when I first started looking. I couldn't find any resistance at all. It seemed to be like they just moved in, said, we'll have that bit, and nobody seemed to complain. And then the Frederick Wright case came up. But again, that's sort of interesting, because it's not just about... somebody I met, again, one of the local history societies, had remembered him, and apparently he was somebody who could have a fight at the drop of a hat. So again, how typical was he? Was he was somebody who, you know, does he represent something, or actually is he just, you know, the individual within a larger story? So, as I say, there's so many gaps, and it's been good to sort of test it a bit and see where they are.
Can I just add one thing?
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Just to add quite one thing about the caddies.
Ray
Van Plew and...
Oh, right.
I certainly did quite a bit of work on caddies. He has quite a bit of published work.
Oh, right, thank you.
In the late 19th and 20th century.
Right.
You know, a lot of on earnings and so forth, which you could plug in.
Yeah, thank you. That would be really useful. Yeah, he did actually contact me, because he was hoping to come today and he couldn't come. So I'm a bit cautious about letting him have the paper because he's so obviously knows so much more than I do. So, but yeah, but that's interesting. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
As a reminder, then we're going to take 10-minute break now just to top up our drinks and so on. Then we're going to move forward with Grace and John. And then follow with Melanie to finish off the morning now. Melanie's about to arrive in her chariot. Okay. Alright, so we'll take 10 minutes if that's okay. I should say as well that Diane's leaving it this afternoon quite early, so if you want to talk to her about Freemasonry, you need to take the opportunity over lunch.
I read it.